and one spark keep the spark alive. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, a look at the road ahead for Jacksonville's crowdfunding festival, One Spark. You can get on the line now. Join us at 549-2937. Then later, local survivors and their children on Holocaust Remembrance Day. Plus, April is National Donate Life Month. We'll tell you about the Katie Ride on Amelia Island and the life-saving power of organ donation. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, this hour has the spark gone out of One Spark. Organizers of Jacksonville's crowdfunding festival were hoping to see as many as 40,000 people at the big event at Daly's Place last weekend, but final attendance fell far short of that. The final numbers have yet to be released, and organizers say the rainy weather, the new location, and other weekend events were some of the reasons why fewer people turned out. Only 67 creators took part in One Spark, and only 16 people rode a free shuttle to the festival that was provided by JTA. What a big come down from the height of the event when it brought some 300,000 people to the city's urban core. So what is the future of the crowdfunding festival? Here with his thoughts on the future or not of One Spark, we welcome Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hey, Tim.
Good to be here.
And here's our question to callers. Did you go to One Spark? Did you take a pass this year? If so, why? What are your thoughts? Should the festival continue? Should it go back to the downtown urban core? What do you think about this? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or you can weigh in on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Tim Gibbons, what a come down over the weekend for this festival, which was held at Daly's Place rather than taking over a big chunk of the urban core footprint. It was a huge street party, brought hundreds of thousands of people. That proved to be too expensive. So this year we see it over at the Daly's Place Amphitheater.
It was a big change. I mean, if you recall going back when it started in, five, six years ago, it was very much that big public energy driven sort of event downtown. And if you were there or if you were checking it out on social media, there was absolutely not that sense of energy this weekend. On the other hand, the organizers, you know, might well say that they weren't trying for that. They definitely were not doing a street festival. They were doing a innovation fest that was they charged admission and they had sponsors, and they weren't trying to get just a bunch of looky-loos wandering the downtown streets having fun.
Sure. And that was disappointing to all the looky-loos.
That's a problem. That's why the lack of energy. And I think there's an argument to be made that what excited people about One Spark, I'm not using looky-loos in a derogatory fashion, basically. No, right. I was a looky-loo. No, I mean, basically the idea that
a casual participant walking around, checking it out.
Right. Having fun, enjoying
having
it.
Having fun.
And I don't know if you recall when One Spark first happened, there was this interesting thing of trying to figure out how to describe it. You know, for a reporter writing about it, they call it the world's largest crowdfunding festival. Technically, it wasn't crowdfunding. It wasn't like Kickstarter. But what was it exactly? And that was kind of a struggle the first year. They kind of sharpened the message for years two and three. And now they're back at that place where if you talk to people, nobody really knows what exactly it was or who it was for. In some ways, the $15 admission price might have been either both too high and too low. Mm. So street festival, it's free. You come down, you buy your beer, you hit the food truck, you look at the guy doing whatever, you know, literally building a better mousetrap one year. And that's free. That's good. Then you look at something like the Florida Venture Forum, which is, you know, serious angel investors, venture capitalists, businesses looking for money. Admission, the walk-up admission there is like $300. So they're getting, you know, money people. 15 kind of scares away the casual fan, but isn't necessarily signaling that this is a thing.
A serious thing for people who are looking to invest their serious money.
Exactly.
What are your thoughts about the future of One Spark for Jacksonville? Did you go or not go over the weekend? Give us a call at 549-2937. So the organizers haven't released final attendance figures, Tim, or indicated if it will happen again next year.
They have said that they will learn lessons from this year, and they're looking at moving forward, which is a really polite way of saying, huh, we're going to sit back and take a look at the numbers. You know, one of the things to remember, and we talk about One Spark in a way is almost like it's a public thing, like it's the Jazz Fest. And it sometimes we have to be reminded that it is an actual, it's a private venture. It was initially funded almost totally by Peter Rummel, who put his own money into it. And when you have something...
And was that a mistake? Let me ask you, to pull off something of that magnitude where you had over a quarter of a million people jamming into the city, partying, buying food and drinks, enjoying the spectacle. Should the city have paid more for that rather than putting it all on the shoulders of this one wealthy man?
That's a good question. The city did contribute money. I want to say it was $50,000 2 years ago. They didn't have an event last year, but there was a small grant. And the rest they were trying to get through sponsorships. They actually had more sponsors in number this year than they did in previous years. I don't know, obviously, in money because it is a private thing. They don't have to release that. But yeah, I mean, the Jazz Fest is a city-run thing.
That's a city-run thing.
The Blues Festival at the beaches, that's a city-run thing. Many of the big public gathering things that we think of either are public-run or, you know, the Home and Garden Show is a ticketed event that has lots of sponsors that has a lot of corporate money behind it. It is a kind of unusual thing to have Elton Rivas, who started this, who's no longer involved, but he had a dream. He got a patron who funded it. And in some ways, it's actually the fact that we're still talking about One Spark is almost a testimony to what a dream and some money can do, whether or not it was successful.
So as a business editor, do you think there's value in Jacksonville trying to continue this fledgling event, which has come to be associated with Jacksonville?
So we editorialized last week that basically we were hopeful that this was obviously before the weekend. We were hopeful that maybe lightning would strike again. One Spark has been many things over its time. What it's never been is a sustainable business. And if you have someone who wants to basically have a money losing concern, well, usually they buy newspapers, but rich people who, you know,
but is the Jazz Festival a business? Is the spring? Is the Blues Festival a business?
Right.
No, those are seen as big events that are good for the city as a whole. They bring people into the downtown footprint. They increase civic pride. They do all these intangible things, but they're not expected to make money.
Right. And people would talk about when One Spark in its second and particularly its third year, when it was actually kind of at its peak, people would talk about coming from other cities for this in the same way they'd come from somewhere else for a concert. It definitely boosted the city's stature. I'm not entirely sure if you can say that a failed One Spark diminishes the city's stature. It definitely doesn't help it though. So should One Spark continue? I think the general sense is not in the way it was done this year, where it's really unclear who the audience was or what the payoff was supposed to be. Is this a fun thing to do on a Saturday afternoon? That's what it used to be. Or is this basically an investing opportunity where you go because you think you can make money? Who's the audience? Why should they go? In some ways, I think were questions that weren't really clearly answered in the public's mind.
One thing, though, that I think is clear is that if you put an event together that's downtown that has buzz and excitement, you can pull people into the city. It was the only time ever in the entire time I've lived in Jacksonville that I rode a packed Skyway.
Yes.
Ever.
And I remember in the second and third year in particular, where again, we editorialized looking at, of all of the things that One Spark does, one of the things it does is shows that downtown can work, that you can actually be, remember, it was during the week. That was the other thing. It wasn't on the weekend.
Yeah.
You had people coming out of office towers, walking outside, going, holy crap, we're a real city. Look at this. Look at all these people. Look at all this excitement. That's a good thing for the city.
Let's go to your calls now. What are your thoughts about the future of OneSpark and how Jacksonville, or if Jacksonville, should try to continue that focus on getting people into the city over and above whether the festival continues? 549-2937. James is in St. John's. Hi, James.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay, thanks.
So I was, when I heard the beginning of the story, I was completely surprised. I don't think I heard one mention or advertisement for the event this year. I was curious, three questions. Who's in charge of promoting the event? Two, what's their budget? And three, are they going to try to do something different next year?
Okay, thanks for all that.
I don't know what their budget was, again, private organization, but it's interesting how many people I have heard say that. If you drive around and look at bus stops, there are OneSpark advertisements on. If you watch TV, weirdly, Saturday night I was watching television and there was an advertisement for it. Mm-hmm. They definitely did advertise, but I think it's one of those situations where you know, you buy a white car and then suddenly you see white cars everywhere sort of thing. If there was buzz about it, if people knew yeah. about it and knew it was coming, then they noticed the ads, but it faded into the background. There was no buzz.
Chad in San Marco. Hello, Chad. Good morning.
Hey, how are you doing, Melissa?
All right. Thank you.
I was a creator at this year's OneSpark. I invented a dance training, sports dance trainer for kids called Stand Perfect. It's standperfect.com if you want to check it out. But
Way to get that plug in, Chad. That's good for you.
I'm good at that. But I'm not griping or anything. I thought it was okay as far as the event went. I thought everybody who tried to pull it off, they were really nice and everybody was super cool at the event. Disappointing turnout, of course, but they still have the voting. You vote, and the people and the creators who get the most votes get the money. And there was a problem there with the IT guys because you could manipulate that and vote as many times as you want. You could just put in a different name and a different email address and a different phone number, and you could vote endlessly all day. So that was a big problem, I thought.
Hmm.
But other than that, I thought that everybody, the staff, everybody did a great job. The people that were loading in and loading out were so nice. I mean, they really tried hard, but it was just the venue was, you really had to make an effort to get out to the stadium and try and do this. When it was downtown, it was far more of a festive atmosphere, and I thought that was pretty enjoyable for the entire city.
Yeah. Would you do it again?
Yeah. Do you want to come back and do it again, Chad?
If they could straighten out that whole thing as far as like legitimately voting for things, that would be a good start there. I would do it again because I think that Peter Rummel did a really good job with the staff, and everyone that was involved was so nice and so polite. It was a really great event. It was just a shame that there weren't enough people.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Chad, and good luck with your project. Good luck with your invention.
Oh, it's on Amazon.
All right. Well, many sales to you, hopefully. Thanks, Chad.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
In some ways, this is that echoes comments that were made even when OneSpark was being more successful. You know, having known and talked and interviewed people who work for OneSpark for years, there's some just truly talented, truly caring people who've worked for it. The thing is, that doesn't translate to financial success necessarily.
And I'd also heard through the years that there was a guy affiliated with it from the beginning who left a couple of years in, and he was sort of the guy who made the trains run on time.
So
you had this big picture visionary at the top.
Yep.
He had some people with him that were sort of more tactical and were like making sure everything was getting done right. And some of those people left, and that's, I heard, that's when it started to have some problems.
They basically brought on a chief operating officer sort of position the second year. And, you know, when they were doing the street festival sort of thing, things as simple as how far apart should bands be. And I remember one of the things,
one of the things he
said was the, you know, you should always be able to turn a corner and look down a street and see something happening. That takes a lot of planning. And it's the, you know, the old, people who win battles talk about logistics sort of thing.
Exactly.
It was somebody who actually got all those little details correct.
Someone who could move men and materiel.
Materiel. You don't talk about materiel enough on this show.
Christy is downtown. Hi, Christy. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I definitely think when OneSpark came through, it was a huge opportunity for so many people in the community, specifically artists, to have a deadline, essentially. And I think what you saw was a collective effort to, bring this festival that really did change things. I think very much it did. So my hopes are that when there are festivals and activities like this, that we try to, as a community, come together and contribute to helping that be innovative again and successful. I just feel like there's sometimes a lot of negativity about how people are actually doing the work they're doing rather than just trying to be part of learning through a process. It's very difficult to run through these types of programs sometimes for the first time in a city.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for all of that feedback.
She makes an interesting point there, and I think it's actually one of the things that has made OneSpark difficult. So she talks about the artists. We've been talking about this as a innovator festival and technology and things like that.
But there were artists too.
Well, right. That was, particularly when it was the street festival idea, it was a range of creative types, which is both a blessing and a curse. The energy is there because you have musicians and you have visual artists and you have, you know, the guy, remember the guy with the wooden bicycle?
Uh-huh.
You know,
forget that guy.
Right. And but he wasn't trying to sell it. He was utterly non-commercial. So you have all of that in the mix. That adds to the excitement. That gets a lot of different people involved. You have to lose that if you're trying to simply go for people who have created products. That might be a good idea, but you're not going to get the same sort of thing. And in some ways, I think the OneSpark brand is more synonymous with the street festival than it is with, you know, getting angel investing.
Yeah, and that was a problem for them. But at the same time, you definitely sense this widespread disappointment with the creative class of this area that couldn't be sustained in some way or another. Mm-hmm. People who value that type of street energy and see that it can ultimately be monetized. Right. You saw all this excitement when we saw a flicker of that, and then a lot of disappointment when it flickered out.
Well, you said something earlier about the, you know, should the city do it? Should the city be involved in funding it? And, you know, I say, well, during the week, you have people coming out of those office towers and really enjoying the city. One might ask, well, okay, so maybe there should have been more involvement from the people who are in those office towers to actually, you know, sponsor it and mm-hmm. provide the funding that if they thought it was a good thing for downtown, they mm-hmm. would make it happen.
All right, and lots of calls as we speak with Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal about the future of OneSpark. Has the spark gone out for this crowdfunding festival? Can it be sustained? Do you think it should? Give us a call at 549-2937. CJ is in San Marco right now. Hi, CJ. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I appreciate you taking my call. I would just like to say, respond a little bit to the artists versus business entrepreneurs aspect to it. I was actually a creator in year two. And
what was your
downtown,
creation?
It's a mobile app, and it's a food management app. It's called Kitchen Cloud, and basically what it does is it helps organize your kitchen and give you notifications when your food's about to expire. And we're trying to integrate it with grocery delivery. So when you need things, it'll be able to order for you when you have ingredients that are low and things like that, and also help track nutrition. So that's what we were working on for the second year, and I chose not to participate as a creator in this OneSpark because I had a feeling that because of the change in venue, and there probably would not be as much of a draw. I think that it was the festival was such a great showcase of downtown when it was there. in the earlier years. And also, I love the fact that it was able to be inclusive of not just business ideas, but also for artists, and you'd have musicians playing in different venues. And it was just such a great atmosphere, and there's just so many people. I think that, you know, maybe as a business model, probably not an effective model. I think it's more, should be more of a sort of a public-private partnership where you have your corporate sponsors and you have city chipping in more, you know, really. And then also, it was a longer festival. So, I think it was from like Wednesday to Sunday. I think we did maybe a Friday to Sunday. I think that could be better.
Okay.
You know, there's so many ideas that you can reform it with. But I definitely would love to see it come back. And, you know, it was such a great showcase of both the downtown, but also just the creativity and the talent, both as far as entrepreneurs and then also for artists and musicians.
Sure.
And food vendors.
Thanks, CJ. Thanks for all of that. Thanks for calling. Okay, let me get to a few tweets and emails. Shauna tweets the show, a crowdfunding event needs a crowd. This year had relatively little advertising hype, and a closed event fee discourages casual drop-in attendees who bring energy. And then on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, Steve writes, it was better when it was a food, art, entertainment, and crowdfunding festival. This year was an expected disappointment. Chrissy writes, the location this year was awful. In the past, it was a reason to go downtown and patronize downtown businesses at the same time. Also, this year, there was no marketing for it, so I had no idea it was coming up or what would be there. Okay. That's the feedback so far, anyway.
And interestingly enough, that feedback strangely shows the desire for something like this, you know, which is, I would think the organizers, you know, assuming they're listening, in some ways have to be cheered by the idea of people going, I didn't know about it and I wish it was different, but it's not like the brand is destroyed. Obviously, there is still a sense of good things were done in the past and maybe this is something that should continue.
There's still goodwill for, a reservoir of goodwill for
yes.
it. Yeah. Okay. Rachel in Jack's Beach. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Hey, we went on Thursday evening, and I was kind of disappointed in that the creators, there was only maybe 60% participation. There were a lot of blank booths, but it was definitely fun. I brought my 13-year-old out, trying to show her the different opportunities, and, you know, she's very interested in creating and inventing and all of these things. She has all kinds of ideas, but we just basically had a lot of fun at Daly's Place playing chess, the patio chess they had out there. So it's my first time checking out Daly's Place, which was great, but I would like to see in the future maybe if they did something great and brought in some of the younger crowd, focus on maybe Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, and trying to get maybe a category for them to compete. I think that that might bring in, obviously, once you have the kids, you have their parents, and then obviously grandparents and extended family comes out. Maybe it'll help with some of the participation, too.
Sure. Thanks for that, Rachel. Lots of interesting calls about this today.
There are. We mentioned earlier that the, you know, the founder of OneSpark isn't involved anymore, and there's, you know, people who have various views of him, and, you know, was he a visionary or was it just a, you know, could he execute, basically? But there is always that issue when somebody starts something and they bring their energy to it and they're not there any longer. That gives the organization an opportunity to kind of pivot. But I think in the early years, the founder's just energy itself almost, I don't know, it was like a reality distortion field that...
Yeah. I mean, Bewitched was never the same after they switched from Dick York to Dick Sargent. I'm sorry. It just was never the same.
Well, but that last caller had, you know, basically that idea of, you know, bringing the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, bring in different people. In some ways, OneSpark has to figure out who and what it is. And I don't think it didn't really know it from the get-go, but at least it had that founding energy. And now it doesn't have either.
Well, it's interesting to talk about this and read in the Business Journal more about this as they've been covering it. And it's always good to have your insights, Tim. So we'll continue to follow it. We'll see what happens next year. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Tim Gibbons is editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Much more still ahead, meanwhile, later, all about this year's Katie Ride on Amelia Island, cycling up some awareness for organ donation. But up next, a look at Holocaust Remembrance Day from the point of view of local survivors and their kids. We'll be right back.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. The Move Over Law protects police, fire, EMS, utility, and sanitation personnel and requires drivers to move over and slow down when approaching their vehicles. More at waynehogan.law.
Community hospice and palliative care. Are you a caregiver? You're not alone. A day of info and inspiration open to the public at Caregiver Expo with special guest Donovan Darius, Saturday, April 14th from 9 to 3 at Everbank Field. Register at mycaregiverconnection.org.
Hi, I'm Miguel Sanon.
I'm Nora Jones.
My name is Pedrito Martinez.
I'm Christian McBride with Jazz Night in America. Our new show is bringing you inside the jazz world. We're headed to concerts around the country, from New York to L.A. to D.C., and we're talking directly to musicians, finding out how and why they do what they do. Join me right here for Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Kevin Murchard. At WJCT, you're able to listen to public radio because someone just like you gave a contribution. We'll start our spring pledge drive this Saturday. You value this programming, and now it's your turn to make that pledge. Go online at wjct.org or call 1-800-722-9528 to contribute. And thank you for your support.
Electro Lounge is now on Spotify. On the road or at home, take us wherever you go. Just search WJCT 89.9 on Spotify, where the Electro Lounge is always on.
Welcome back. Well, Israel came to a standstill at 10 o'clock this morning as sirens wailed throughout the country in memory of the 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis during World War II. Ceremonies marking Holocaust Remembrance Day also took place in Europe. Here in the U.S., the topic of remembrance and bearing witness is also top of mind for many, including the descendants of Holocaust survivors, the second generation, as they're called. Naomi Chase is one of them. She's the daughter of a survivor and lives here in Jacksonville. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And so in Israel, Holocaust Remembrance Day is a national remembrance. It's scheduled on the same date as the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And it's such an important day in Israel and in European capitals, too. Here in America, it's less observed, but it's important to talk about because this is something the entire world, I think, needs to always every year pause and reflect about.
Yeah. So I want to clarify something. The name of the day, Yom HaShoah, is actually Yom HaShoah VeHagvura. It's actually, so those words mean day of devastation and heroism. This acknowledges many things. They are all bound up in the history of how it got on the Jewish calendar, how the commemoration got its name, and how it is now observed. So that's really important to me. The argument in Israel in 1951 was 2 years old at that point, and it represented two main antagonists. One was the Warsaw Ghetto fighters and their alliance, their the people who allied themselves with them. But it was also the Orthodox who argued that there shouldn't be anything inserted into the Jewish calendar. So the 15th of Nisan would have been the date that the fighters, the Warsaw Ghettos, would have wanted to commemorate the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. But the Orthodox didn't want it then because it would have violated a prohibition against mourning during the Passover season or the month of Nisan, the Hebrew month of Nisan. The compromise was the 27th of the Hebrew month of Nisan, which put it on the calendar.
Which is today.
Right.
Okay. And so all over the world, Jews and non-Jews reflect on this, including survivors of the Holocaust and including the descendants of survivors. And you're one of them. Can you tell us a little bit about your family's story?
Yeah. So my father survived the Holocaust by escaping from the Polish army to which he had been conscripted when he was 18. He left behind parents and siblings. I am named for the last sister he saw alive. He rarely spoke of the decade that he spent in Israel, from 44 to 54, looking for survivors and relatives, up a decade that ended in a deafening silence of despair.
Because he was unable to find...
He never found anyone.
Any of his family.
Anyone who even knew them.
And so then he came to America?
He did. He just a fluke, a strange series of serendipitous events helped him locate a distant sort of non-relative. It was a man who had been married to a sister of his mother's. It was a second marriage. Anyway, brought him to Cleveland, Ohio.
And that's where you grew up?
That's where I grew up. He met my mother because she lived across the street. It was kind of a setup, I guess. But the family folklore says that the first thing he said to her is, "I are a soldier in the Israeli army."
Oh, funny.
And she was smitten.
Oh, funny.
She was American.
So he was, I'm guessing through a combination of luck and smarts, able to escape the Holocaust. How was he able to escape?
So his story is sketchy to me because he really never spoke of it. It was very, very hard for him to talk about it. He did tell my mother, and she doled it out to me and my sisters in bits and pieces, sort of by way of explaining some idiosyncrasies of his personality. But he walked. He left the Polish army, where they weren't very appreciative of their Jewish soldiers. Yeah. He left. He walked across Europe. He ended up as a stowaway in a ship, and he got to Palestine.
Wow. And you mentioned that he didn't talk about it a lot with you and your siblings. So for the second generation, which is your of this tragedy, how did that affect you?
So there's been a tremendous amount of research on second-gen Holocaust survivors. If you research it, there seems to have been a great deal of it published in 2010. I'm not sure what was significant about 2010, but the research has been going on for a very long time. There's a woman named Helen Epstein, who is herself the daughter of a survivor. Her work has been published in a variety of ways, many different publications. But she documents a lot of symptoms that we all share as second-gen survivors, one of which that is extraordinarily compelling to me is we overwhelmingly share a common sentiment that we could not have endured what our parents survived. I beg to differ. I think of all of the things that we inherit. Her research suggests that there's a transmission of a literal alteration of DNA that gets transmitted,
yeah.
that we inherit the trauma.
The molecular,
yeah.
cellular level,
right.
Trauma gets passed down.
Right.
Yeah.
I believe that. I mean, I can understand how that's possible. But I think we inherited more than that. I'd like to think that I also survived. I also inherited my father's survival instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very hard worker, and he abhorred injustice. And I think he transmitted all of those things to me and to my sisters, too. He chose life. And I'd like to think that we do, too.
And in that sentiment, in that tradition, you are the creator and founder of Jacksonville's newest approach to Jewish learning at home with Judaism. People can learn more on your website, which is jacksonvillejewishlife.com. And so you're taking ancient traditions and sort of bringing them to a new audience, I guess, in some ways. Is that part of the approach?
Yes. I think innovation in Judaism writ large, and certainly in Jewish education, is pivotal and important. Our survival is attributable not only to our desire to hold on to, keep, remember, and treasure, but also to advance and adapt and evolve. So I think Jewish education plays a really important role in that, bringing it to people in these new ways, bringing it to them literally and figuratively into their homes, makes it a whole different way of engaging in it. And I have a lot of training in different, you know, modalities and teaching strategies, so I can really accommodate different learning styles and audiences. Uh-huh.
Well, it's so good to speak with you on this important day, and we thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your family's history. I think it's so helpful for people to hear a personal story like that and understanding the significance of it. So thanks, Naomi, so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Naomi Chase is a second-generation Holocaust survivor. She's the founder of At Home with Judaism. You can access that at jacksonvillejewishlife.com. And still to come, a look ahead to Generation W coming up tomorrow on the UNF campus. But in a moment, we'll spotlight National Donate Life Month and the life-saving power of organ donation. That's next.
Family's Palestinian, and so you always get stopped when you get to the airport. And this time it wasn't actually going that bad until the second I stepped out into Ben-Gurion airport and someone just said, step over here.
Join us next time for stories about the kindness of strangers. From Portugal to Pittsburgh, from Texas to Palestine. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Well, right now we want to tell you about a premier cycling event on the First Coast. It's not only a lot of fun, it also raises awareness about organ donation. This month, April, is National Donate Life Month. And that means it's the time of year again for the 14th annual Katy Ride for Life, coming up next weekend up on Amelia Island. Event sponsor is Mayo Clinic. Right now we're pleased to welcome Dr. Martin May. Is it May or my?
It's May.
Dr. Martin May, kidney transplant specialist with Mayo. Hey, doctor.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And Amy Reese is here. She's spokesperson for the Katy Caples Foundation. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for having us.
In a moment, we'll speak with the doctor about all the great work Mayo does with organ transplants. But first, let's tell everyone a little bit about the Katy Ride. It's named, of course, in honor of the late Katy Caples, a young woman who lost her life, but she saved a lot of other lives because she wanted her organs to go to people that needed them.
She did. So when Katy got her driver's license and was asked, you know, do you want to be an organ donor? She said, absolutely. She looked at her dad and said, why wouldn't I? And then, unfortunately, Katy was in an accident where she suffered a severe brain injury, and her parents knew her wishes, were able to fulfill those. And she saved five lives, from a 9-year-old to a 62-year-old.
Wow. And so that's an example of how, if everybody agreed to be an organ donor, what a difference it would make. Because a lot of people feel uncomfortable with it, or they don't even know they can do it, right? This is all to raise awareness about it.
Absolutely. And people can register to be an organ donor if they haven't done so at donatelifeflorida.org.
Donatelifeflorida.org, because April is National Donate Life Month. Dr. May, more than 100,000 adults and kids in the U.S. are waiting for an organ transplant. They need it just to live. It's a life-saving opportunity, but not enough people want to become an organ donor. So tell us a little bit about Mayo Clinic's role in this.
So Mayo Clinic has now been offering transplant in this community for 20 years. We've helped save over 6,000 lives, and this is a valuable effort of bringing education to high schools, other areas, and teaching people their opportunity to donate. As Katy helped five lives, each potential donor can help that or even more. Mm-hmm. Tissue and eyes can be used, maybe not in a life-saving way, but
in a huge quality of life improvement. So the deceased donor wait list is long. The 20 people die each day waiting for an organ. The more people that give that kind gift, the more people that we can help.
That we can help. And as you pointed out, Katie Caples indicated she wanted to be an organ donor when she got her driver's license. A lot of people can do it that way. But there's an extra step you can take, too, isn't there, to make sure, Amy, that people know this is your wish?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's important to register to be a donor, but also talk to your families and share your decision. Have a discussion about it.
And what are the biggest myths about organ donation? Because most Americans, I think your data shows, 95% of us say they support this idea of organ donation, but less than half of us actually register to become one.
Right. And I think it's just taking that action. But probably the number one myth in America is people think if I'm an organ donor, they're not going to work to save my life. They're going to use my organs for someone else. And that is not true. Signing up to be an organ, tissue, and eye donor does not affect the care that you will receive.
Okay. So don't believe that myth. And doctor, what are some other, ways that organ donation is so important? And what are the most common operations you're doing at Mayo when it comes to this, to transplant? And because Mayo is a leader in this.
So we offer organ transplant in heart, lung, kidney, pancreas, and liver. We have programs that on the kidney side, we're doing about 160 kidneys, about 160 livers each year. In the kidney side, there's an opportunity for deceased donation, but also living donation. So we encourage, if you know someone that has suffering kidney disease, you may be able to help them off. Mm-hmm. You may help them get that kidney quicker, help them live longer, enjoy that quality of life. And importantly, there's no sacrifice in your life. You live just as long with one kidney as you do two. So that's another opportunity that we want to share.
Sure. Okay. With all of that said, let's talk about the big event, the ride. How can people be part of the ride? What's on the agenda?
Well, we have different courses of the cycling event. You can choose. You can come and walk with the family along the Greenway there in Amelia Island. We also have a triathlon that's a lot of fun with the bike swim and run. And you can register online at katiecaples.org, but you can also come day of if you want to wait to see how beautiful the forecast is going to be coming up Saturday morning.
And so many people tend to do that, don't they?
Yes.
Which you probably wish they wouldn't, but that is kind of what happens. Yes, it's katiecaples.org. Go to katiecaples.org and learn about the foundation and also the 14th annual Katie Ride for Life. It's coming up Saturday, April 21st on Amelia Island. It's just a beautiful way to support this and have fun with your whole family, really. It's a really cool event. And so kudos to you, Amy Reese, with Katie Caples Foundation and Dr. May, as Mayo celebrates the 20th anniversary of its transplant program here in Jacksonville. Kudos to you on that as well. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's
Thank
a pleasure.
You.
Again, that's Saturday, April 21st, the 14th annual Katie Ride. Okay, a quick break. And in a moment, we look ahead to another big event for the city, Generation W. That's after this.
You're moving to the rock and sound.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Are you a caregiver? You're not alone. A day of info and inspiration open to the public at Caregiver Expo with special guest Donovan Darius, Saturday, April 14th from 9 to 3 at Everbank Field. Register at mycaregiverconnection.org.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. It's the number one killer of teens. One text or call can wreck it all. Arrive alive. Let's end distracted driving. More from board-certified civil trial lawyer Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
On the next Fresh Air, how our cities have become unaffordable for poor people and how that's led to more evictions. We'll talk with Matthew Desmond, whose book Eviction won a Pulitzer Prize. His new project, The Eviction Lab, is based in Princeton University, where he teaches. It's collected millions of eviction records to help understand eviction's causes and consequences. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Next time on The World.
We're going to Tijuana to pick up 23 greyhounds.
A couple in California cross the border on a regular basis to a dog track in Tijuana, where greyhounds are at the end of their racing days. The dogs would be euthanized, but now they get a second chance as pets in the U.S. Crossing the border with 23 greyhounds on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sally Cohn says she learned how to disagree respectfully during her many appearances on Fox News, but she admits kindness is complicated these days. Now she's focused on confronting the human capacity for hate and how we use it to beat down others. Is anyone listening? Sally Cohn on the need to be nice. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, just one more day till Generation W is back on the UNF campus. WJCT is a media sponsor of this event. It is the area's premier women's leadership event for Northeast Florida. We've got a preview right now. Spokeswoman Angela Spears is here in studio. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you. And on the phone, we're pleased to welcome Gay Gaddis, CEO and founder of T3, the think tank. Hi, Gay.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. So what a successful businesswoman you are. You started your company in the 80s because you cashed out, I'm told, a $16,000 IRA to start T3. It's gone on to be one of the largest innovation firm agencies owned by a woman in the country. So kudos to you. This is so exciting to hear your story. You're going to be sharing some of this at Generation W. Tell us a little bit about your talk.
Yes. Well, I've also just written a book that came out in January called Cowgirl Power. And I will be talking
nice.
About some of the high points of that. You know, I am from Texas, but the book is really giving my life story of, and then starting a business, the ups and downs of that, all the lessons learned through the years. And I've got some pretty good advice in there that I think will help a lot of the younger folks and give them some opportunities to really increase opportunities and gain that personal power that comes from within. And that's the kind of power I'm talking about.
Gay will be on the stage at Gen W, Angela, along with a lot of other really dynamic women and men.
Women and men, Melissa.
Yeah. And they'll be sharing stories like hers. It's a really inspiring day.
This is one day that will last all year long. The excitement continues to build. This is magic when Generation W happens. The excitement in Melissa is building so much that we have people still registering. We have people at 1 o'clock this morning registering for this event. And some of the speakers include Rashida Ali, Muhammad Ali's daughter. She will talk about the Ali in all of us, the greatness in all of us. We have the performance coach for the Chicago Bulls, Dr. Wendy Balarbi, who I am told is just an awesome, awesome woman. I cannot wait to meet her. We have the founder of the hashtag Be Awesome to Somebody movement, the global chief marketing officer of Hyatt Global, of Hyatt Hotel Corporation. So just a few of the speakers, mm-hmm. including speakers like Gay. So this mm-hmm. is going to be a wonderful day for us all to be inspired, to be motivated. We're going to leave there, I think, tomorrow. I know. We're going to leave there empowered, Melissa.
Yes, and Gay, that is really the message I think you have, particularly for younger women establishing their careers. And it can be inspiring to see someone like you up on this stage sharing your story like that.
Well, especially because, you know, I did start my business from the ground up with a $16,000 IRA. And so it's a dream come true in many ways.
Were you scared when you did that?
I was very scared.
I bet.
I would be terrified.
Was that your only retirement money?
Yes, it was all I had. You have to understand that the late 80s was a terrible recession. So I think the message of hope that I give and empowerment to women and to men is that, guess what? Anything can happen. You know, if you really put your mind to it and you really, and like I said, I ate risk for breakfast every day when I first started the company. And I have a high tolerance for risk, thank goodness. But yes, I'm just hoping to lay some groundwork for people to say, yes, I can take that next promotion. I can get that raise. I can apply for that job, or I can really do things that I never thought I could do because I have a story that can inspire them, I hope, because that's what I've done.
And
pretty incredible.
That is incredible. And you'll be able to meet women and women like A. So she'll be there all
right,
day
not,
long.
You, not just hear the talk, you can meet them.
Yes.
Connect and that's network.
Yeah. She's having a book signing. And so that's what's so wonderful about it. And Melissa, we're going to end the day with a networking social hour because that's what it's about, right? Because we're going to go from, we've had the hashtag, this is time is up, hashtag me too. We're going to launch tomorrow a hashtag our time. This is our time to do great things here in Jacksonville. It's our time to spread that message all across the state, all across the country. And you'll be able to actually meet them. And we can talk about this during our during the social hour of what we're going to do next to make things wonderful here in our city.
That's great. And still not too late to register to attend Generation W. Go to genwnow.com. Come on out to the UNF campus tomorrow. And thanks so much, Angela Spears and Gay Gaddis, CEO and founder of T3, the think tank. Have fun out there tomorrow.
Melissa, I have to thank our partners really, really quickly. APR Energy, Wells Fargo, thank you, thank you, thank you for giving tickets to military and veterans, KPMG, PepsiCo, Florida Blue, getting it in.
All right.
Got it in.
Okay. All right. Thanks, ladies.
Very good.
Thanks, Gay. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Kevin Merchard is our producer. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Pyotr Chevchik of the Symphony composed our show theme. 1A's up next, looking at a new book exploring the human emotion of hate and how to get beyond it. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCTFM Jacksonville, your community, your world. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, just stay tuned for music. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow with our Friday Media Roundtable. See you then. And have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.